Over the past couple of weeks, I've had several conversations, and this word keeps coming up, seasons. There's these seasons, seasons in life. I know for those of us that have spent our life here in East Texas, we're a bit confused when people start to talk about seasons. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, I was in a meeting in Houston, and we were talking to a new employee that had recently migrated to the south, to Texas, and we're talking about seasons. I said, well, what you need to know about seasons in Texas is we have six seasons. He said, six seasons? I said, yes, we have football season, we have dove season, we have deer season, we have duck season, and we have baseball season, and we have summer. Those are our seasons here. And he was just, you know, so confused. But there's a different type of season that I want us to talk about today. And let me give you the definition that I want to use today. The definition of a season that I want to use today is this. It's a period of time set aside for a particular purpose. It's a period of time set aside for a particular purpose. And the reason I want to hone in on this idea of seasons this morning is that because God often chooses to work in the lives of his people through seasons, distinct periods of time in which he sovereignly arranges the details and circumstances and situations of our life to bring about a particular purpose. And it's either going to be in our life or for our life individually, or it may be for the life of the church corporately. And it's in those seasons, and it's a result of those seasons, that he is either preparing us or engaging us for his kingdom purposes. I want to ask you this question as we begin this morning. What season has God placed you in today? Now, are you in a season of transition? Are you in a season of waiting, maybe indecision, suffering some sort of hardship? Are you in a season of loneliness and isolation? Maybe you're the opposite. You're in a season where you're growing in community and you're gaining in friendship. Maybe you're in a season of growth, a season of success. Maybe you're in a season of confusion. Maybe for you, you're in a season of family dysfunction. Maybe it's new beginnings. Listen, whether it's a time of triumph or it's a time of trials, your season isn't pointless. Consider the season that you're in right now and then ask yourself this question. How is God using this season to shape and grow or test my faith? How is God using this season to shape me or to grow me or to test my faith? Whether you're in a season of triumph or you're in a period of trials, you can be assured that God has a purpose in it. Whether for you it's trials or whether for you it's triumph, it's not pointless. God has a purpose in it. We're going to see that from God's word today. I'm going to ask you to take your Bibles and find the book of Esther. Find the book of Esther. It's right after the book of Nehemiah, if that helps, in the Old Testament. It's not a place we often go to, but it's where we're going to be today, the book of Esther. As you're getting there, let me give you a little bit of background so you can understand what's happening in this book. The characters that we're going to read about in the book today are going to each experience some specific seasons that seem to them at the time like they're completely unrelated. They're going to seem as though they're random or from their perspective by chance, only to discover in the end that it's all been pieced together perfectly to bring about God's will for his people. And this, again, for us is helping to shape our understanding of God's redemptive plan for humanity, The book of Esther is unique. It is the only book in the Bible that never mentions the name of God. So why then are we studying it? Well, although God's name is never mentioned, it's clear that he's the one in the whole picture of this book that's orchestrating the events to bring about a definitive rescue for the Jewish people. Ultimately, that he would be rescuing a remnant to ensure that the line of David continues so that the Messiah would indeed fulfill the prophets. The book gets its name after one of the main characters in the story, this person named Esther. She was an orphaned Jew. She was living as an exile in the land of Persia. And she was being raised by her older cousin, a guy by the name of Mordecai. Now, through a sequence of bizarre events, and we're going to get into those this morning, she eventually becomes the queen of the empire at the very moment where another Persian official, a guy named Haman, is orchestrating a legal pathway to eradicate the Jewish people. What we're going to see today is that God had prepared Esther for such a time as this to save his covenant people. Throughout the book, what we're going to see is that God's sovereign hand is preserving his people, showing that in everything it's under his control. Esther's unusual story is part of Scripture, and it matters to us today because it's a clear picture of God's providential protection of his covenant people. The events that are going to be described in the book occur around 400 BC, so about 400 years before the birth of Christ, during the reign of the Persian king Ahasuerus. I hope I didn't butcher that too bad, but Ahasuerus was an arrogant ruler, and he throws a party one day. And he had a beautiful queen, and him and his buddies are partying. They're wasted at this point. He said, "Have y'all seen the queen?" And he's like, "Send for the queen. Have her parade her beauty through the palace so everybody can look and think about how awesome a guy I am to have this beautiful woman." And she said, "No, not going to do it." Well, he said, "Fine." He disposes her as queen, takes the crown away, and then launches an empire-wide search for the next queen, for a replacement. The quest for a new queen is this elaborate process that's going to take about 4 years. And during this season of searching for a new queen, this young Jewish orphan girl named Esther is going to be brought before the king for consideration. We pick up reading in part her story, Esther chapter 2, and just a couple of verses here, 5 through 7, it says this: "Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried with Jehochanan, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away." So they've been taken from their land as exiles. Now he was bringing up Hadassah, who was Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. And the young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Then you skip down to verse 16 and 17. It says this: "And when Esther was taken to the king, into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebet, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won grace and favor in his sight more than all the other virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." So she comes in, she wins the favor of the king because she's so beautiful, and he crowns her the new queen. I need you to know that becoming the queen of Persia was never Esther's ambition. It wasn't something that Jewish exiles even considered to be a possibility. Mordecai didn't move to Susa to hang out at the palace, hoping one day Esther's beauty would captivate them and then they would somehow be rewarded by it. They were just living an ordinary life in the season that God had placed them in, and they're honoring God with the way that they live. And then God begins placing them into strategic positions to bring about his plan for his people. Even in our most trying situations, God is always working for the long-term good, even if in the short term, it's not clear how he's doing so. And he wants his people to trust him wholeheartedly and confidently, even in the midst of what seems like radical and unexpected change. Now, here's what I want you to notice today is that God is at work in the ordinary seasons of life. God's at work in the ordinary seasons of life. Time and again in Scripture, we are reminded that God orchestrates what seems like the most seemingly insignificant moments in our life to bring about his glory. The king crowned Esther as queen, but Esther had not made known to him that she was a Jew. And God made sure that her identity was hidden while she captured the heart of the king. And God then put her into the place of influence before the threat of execution was enacted. Furthermore, God is going to use an ordinary day to bring judgment on an evil man and bring honor to a God-fearing man. We pick up the story in Esther chapter 2, verse 20. It says this: Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was being brought up by him. In those days, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on the king. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. And when the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Chapter 3, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set him set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. The king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" When they spoke to him day after day, he would not listen to them. And they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. He wants to eliminate the Jewish people from the land of Persia, the place where they've been exiled. Haman was a Canaanite who hated the Jews. He was also a powerful officer in the king's court. And when Mordecai failed to show him the respect that he desired, he determined to fix it by just eliminating all Jewish people from the land. What we're going to find later in chapter 3, if you were to read on, is that Haman convinces the king that the Jews are a threat to the kingdom and a threat to their national security. And so as a result, he obtained a royal decree setting aside a particular day that all of the Jewish people were to be slaughtered. So between the point of the decree and to the day of the slaughter, they were in the process of rounding up the Jews. And we see this repeated in history, don't we? They round up the Jews, and then they have a day of a set aside that's going to be the day of execution. But God's at work in these ordinary seasons of life. Esther's captivating beauty, Mordecai's honorable reporting, even Haman's hatred and evil plan are a part of the way that God is going to set up for the delivery of his people. Chapter 3, verse 15, it says, "The couriers went out and hurried by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel," which, remember, this is where the story takes place, "and the king and Haman, they sat down to drink." They have a time of celebration. "But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion." Why? This is where the exiles of the Jews had landed. Then we pick up in chapter 4. This is really the most critical part of the whole book of Esther, is chapter 4. And here it is. "When Mordecai learned that all had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and he put on sackcloth and ashes and he went out into the midst of the city and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. And he went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter into the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province where the king's command and his decree had reached, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and lamenting, for many of them lay sackcloth in ashes. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he wouldn't accept them. Then Esther called for Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. And he went to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasury for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king and beg for his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And he went and told Esther what Mordecai had said, and Esther spoke to him and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, all the king's servants and the people of the king's province know that if a man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law, to be put to death, except for the one who the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I've not been called to come into the king these 30 days. They told Mordecai what Esther said. Then Mordecai replied to her, do not think of yourself that in the king's palace you'll escape more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come into the kingdom for such a time as this. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will do the same. We'll fast as you do. Then I'll go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Mordecai went away and did everything that Esther had ordered him. God works in ordinary seasons of life. But there's a moment of action, and here's what I need you to hear. Obey God regardless of the outcome. Obey God regardless of the outcome. Esther was in a position to make a difference, but she had to trust God. Mordecai challenged her with this truth that God has a specific season of your life. The deliverance of the Jews was certain because it was God's will. But Esther, to participate, to have a role in that deliverance, she would have to trust God with her life. What did she say? Listen, everybody knows that if you haven't been called before the king, there's only one law. That if you go into the inner court, the law is if you weren't called, you're put to death. Unless, as they come to seize you, he puts out the golden scepter and says, no, spare the life. She says, if I go in, I can't be guaranteed that I'll come out. In fact, there's a greater probability if I go in that I'll be killed. Do you remember what happened to the last queen? She just wouldn't come out of her bedroom and he kicked her out of the palace. Surely if I break the law by going in, he'll have my head. And by the way, here's my status with the king. I haven't seen him in 30 days. Things aren't great at home right now. You think if I go before him, he's going to welcome me in? The stakes were high. The risks were great. Even the king could have been put to death. But Esther decided that she would indeed trust God and intervene for her people. And this is a critical juncture in the storyline because it teaches us several things. I want to show those to you. The first thing it teaches us is this. Obedience may require you to enter a dangerous situation without the guarantee of safety. Now, I think that's something we have a really hard time wrapping our minds around sometimes here. But it's something that believers across the ocean face every single day. Just to live for Christ sometimes puts their life in danger. Listen, sometimes to be obedient to what God calls you to do, you're going to have to enter into a space or into a season in which your safety isn't guaranteed. But here's the second thing I want you to know. Because God is sovereign, you can trust him wholeheartedly. Because God is sovereign over all things, you can trust him with your very life. But don't do it foolishly. Here's the third thing. Prepare spiritually for action. You notice that she didn't get the note and immediately beeline down the hall and bust into the door of the throne room and be like, hey, we got to have a talk. That's not what happened at all. In fact, she took several days to pray and to fast, not just her, but her whole company of attendants and every Jew that could be found in Susa. The largest city in the Persian Empire, the capital city, they said this is where the bulk of the people would have been. Gather everybody for 3 days. Pray, fast, seek the Lord with me as I prepare to go before the king. Listen, sometimes God's going to call you to do something. The guarantee of safety isn't there. You can trust him, but don't do it rashly. Prepare spiritually before you act. And don't do it alone. There's a reason why God calls us into a community of faith. It's so that we have brothers and sisters in Christ who love us and want God's plan and will for our life. And when you say, hey, God, put this on my life, would you pray for me? Would you pray with me about this for a couple of days before I have to go and make this very important decision? Do you think the people in this church would say, no, won't do it? They better not. I believe that they would be glad to do that. Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, hold a fast on my behalf, don't eat or drink for 3 days or nights, and we will do the same. Then I'll go to the king, and even if it's against the law, and if I perish, I perish. And then this happens. Chapter 5. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace. She went in front of the king's quarters. While the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand, which means, I'm going to spare your life. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, even if you ask for half of my kingdom. And Esther said, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I prepared for the king. Let me tell you what happens next. The queen prepares a 2-day feast. And she invites two people only, the king and Haman. Haman thought that this feast was given in his honor. But let me tell you what Esther's doing. She's setting the table for a grander request. Between the first night and the second night, it says that Haman was happy but that he saw Mordecai and he was filled with wrath. And then he went home and he couldn't stop talking about how he had been honored by the queen but disrespected by Mordecai. Now he assumed the next day that the request was going to come and that he was going to be made a very wealthy man because he had been invited to the second day of the feast. That would be the day that surely he'd be rewarded. But all the money in the world wouldn't appease his hatred for the Jews. And he's talking about this with his wife and his friends that night. They convince him, look, why don't we celebrate this recognition that you're going to receive by hanging Mordecai in the palace garden? So the rest of the night, you know what they do? They build gallows in the garden. They're preparing. Chapter 6. But on that night, the king couldn't go to sleep. You ever had those moments? God's at work. King couldn't go to sleep. And he gave orders to bring the book of the memorable deeds and the chronicles that they may be read before me. Well, a little light reading of the chronicles, that'll put me to sleep, the king thinks. Bring me the history books. Works every time. Yeah, it was written and found how Mordecai had told about the two guys, the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, who had sought to lay hands on the king. And the king said, what honor, distinction's been given and bestowed upon Mordecai for this? The king's young men who attended him said, nothing was ever done for him. And I hear a racket out in the garden. The king says, hey, who's in the court? Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak with the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's young men told him, Haman is here standing in the court. And he said, let him come in. So Haman came in. The king said to him, what shall be done for a man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman thinks this is him. Haman said to himself, who would the king delight to honor more than me? Haman said to the king, for the man who the king delights to honor, let the royal robes be brought in which the king is worn, and the horse the king has ridden, and whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man who the king delights to honor him. Let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then the king said to Haman, hurry. Take the robes and the horse that you've said and do so to Mordecai the Jew who sits at the king's gate. Leave nothing out that you've mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city proclaiming before him, thus it shall be done for the man who the king delights to honor. But Mordecai returned to the king's gate. Now Haman hurried to his house mourning with his head covered. Haman told his wife and all of his friends everything that had happened to him. And the wise men and his wife said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but you will surely fall before him. During the banquet that would come after this, the Queen Esther, the king would ask her, what is your request? Let it be made. And she got right to the point this time and said, I want to spare my life and the life of my people. It was clear now to the king that she was indeed a Jew. She explained that her people had become slaves. They're being gathered up for execution. The king requested a little more information about who would do this horrible thing to Esther and her people. Esther revealed that it was Haman that was the enemy. And then the king remembered the conversation that he had had and the party that they had thrown to celebrate this edict that he had released to kill all the Jews. The king knew that he'd been deceived, and so he took a stroll through the garden to clear his head. I need a minute. Let me make sense of all of this. And he goes out, and as he leaves out, it's Haman and Esther in there. Now, they're having dinner. And now, in those days, you kind of recline on your shoulder at a couch. So you didn't sit in a chair, you kind of recline at a couch at a slow table. And Haman, he falls at her feet, gaveling and just groveling and just like, please don't do this, don't do this. I'll do anything. I'll give you any money. What do you want? I don't want this. And he's like touching her. And like she's laying down at the dinner table and he's like laid on her like begging for life. When the king walks in and he sees this and he says, "What now? You'll attack my queen as well?" It wasn't a good sight. At the king's orders, Haman was taken and he was hung on the gallows that he had constructed for Mordecai. And then his land and his home and all of his possessions were given over to Mordecai. The tables had been turned and a new edict was issued that allowed the Jews to defend themselves. He couldn't overturn the previous one, but he said, "Hey, you can still attack the Jews, but they have to be able to defend themselves." This proved not only to enable their defense, but it actually ensured that they had victory over all the enemies they had in Persia. And for several days, they defended themselves and became one of the most powerful people in the land. Because of their faithfulness, Esther and Mordecai, because of their faithfulness, the Jewish people were protected because of the work that they enabled God to do through them. And in it, they didn't receive glory. God did. Everyone knew this is the handiwork of God to take these two commoners and bring about this elaborate plan. God received glory for all that he had done. And listen, although his name is never explicitly mentioned in the book of Esther, the book of Esther, it emphasizes the providence of God and the power of people of God that pray and fast and seek his will and the persuasive potential of courageous men and women who just act in faith as God calls them to. Here's what I want you to know today. God has a plan for this season in your life too. God has given you some measure of influence. Don't waste your influence. Don't waste your influence. It was God's will to rescue a remnant of his people to ensure that the line of David would continue until the birth of Christ. It was God's will for Mordecai to be a mentor who faithfully and courageously educated and inspired a young leader. It was God's will for Esther to courageously go before the king. But for both Esther and Mordecai, there was a choice. They had to choose to step into what God was calling them to. And listen, God has a purpose for your life also. There's something that he's calling you to. There's a position of influence that he's given you. The question remains, will you step into it? Don't waste your influence. I wonder what season you're in right now. Even if it seems ordinary to you, or maybe it seems painful to you, maybe for you right now, all your plans seem to be working out beautiful. I want to encourage you to look at your season and look for the hand of God. Look for him working in that to bring about his plan for your life and his will for his people. Because no matter what kind of season you're in, you have some measure of influence. Are you going to use your influence for God's glory? Do you sense that God is preparing you or calling you for a bold action? Listen, don't proceed alone. Call on fellow believers to join you in a season of prayer and a season of fasting and seek wisdom and courage together. And then step boldly into what it is that God's calling you to do. What you're going to find as we do that is that unity and prayer yields powerful results. Don't waste your influence. Offer yourself into God's service in this and in every season because he has a purpose for you.